Cairo, Seattle.
It's time to get schooled with a professor, John Clayton.
Welcome to Schooled with the Professor, John Clayton here. And of course, one of the things that's really great is that, you know, you kind of go back in history. And I go back all this way with Gary Myers back when he was at the Dallas Morning News covering the Dallas Cowboys. And what the relationship started is that I was in great, because I was at the Pittsburgh Press. And Vito Stellina was at the Post Gazette. Now, I'm the PM, he's the AM. You know, Vito was always the one to break the story. And I was came off the Penn State beat after Joe Paterno kicked me off the beat for breaking too many stories. And so after always covering the Steelers all through high school and college and all that stuff, finally got on the Steelers. And so one of my missions, because Vito would always get a salary survey from the NFL Players Association, and I was in competition. I was able to get that. Well, right out of the blue, here comes Gary Myers, and he was able to get it. And, you know, the first thing I did, because it's like, am I going to, like, throw my hands down and throw something that's, like, be upset? You know, call up Gary and congratulate him, because I know what it was to be able to get the first one away from Vito, and then he got it away from me, and we've been friends ever since, and we've got a lot to talk about. Gary Myers joins us on School with the Professor. Gary, our relationship has been great for so many years.
I really enjoyed it, and I do remember that, and I actually tell the story in the book how I got it. You know, it was the first time the NFLPA put out a salary survey, and it wasn't very complete. You know, it just had the base salaries, although the signing bonuses in those days and the incentives, you know, weren't what they are today, obviously. Even percentage-wise, it wasn't what they are today. So Everson Walls gets the – and he was my best source in the Cowboys, and we were really – you know, we weren't that far apart in age, and he was always so helpful to me. So he calls me up one day, and he says, you're not going to believe what just came in the mail. The NFLPA put out this salary survey. It's like a 40-page booklet, and you can have it. I go, oh, man, that'll be great. He goes, here's the thing. I'm leaving my house in 45 minutes to go out of town for a week. If you can get here before I leave, it's all yours. Otherwise, I'll have somebody mail it to you or whatever. And I said, no, I'll be there. So I got in my car. I raced out of downtown Dallas, which it was a route that took me right past the book depository and the grassy knoll, which became second nature after a while living in Dallas. And I sped up to his house, and he's standing on the steps of his house with a booklet in his hand, and he says, you just made it. I was about to leave. And then, Johnny, what I remember is we printed it the next day in the morning news, like it was a New York Stock Exchange report. We had every salary. But those were way before the days where it would have been easy for you to see what I had and just pick out the Steelers' names. I mean, there was no internet. There was no way for me to get that to you. But when you called me and you said, this is unbelievable, you know, could you just read me the Steelers' names, I was more than happy to do it.
Yeah.
And that was the start of our friendship. And that's, you know, it's almost 40 years, so.
I know. Well, and the funny part is, what I had to do was that I had a little longer commute than you did, because to get it, and knowing that Vito was going to get it, I had to fly down to D.C. and meet somebody at the airport, and then they gave it to me. So I got the paper to pay for. Of course, it was great because, well, at that time, you'd even have the miles, so the miles were irrelevant. But, you know, it would have been even better now because, I mean, you need the miles. But so I had to fly down to D.C., then come back, and then write. And it was, and of course, you know, and then Vito, that was a great part, because Vito's been a friend for so many years. He's down in Jacksonville right now. But I mean, that was just so much fun. And now it's interesting, because I mean, the survey that they put out then is probably like about 1% of all the stuff that they have right now, because it didn't have, you know, everything, but it just had some things. But it was still great.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, like I said, it was just the base salaries. It had no signing bonuses, no incentives, no escalator clauses, no options, you know, all that kind of stuff. It was, you know, it happened back then. It was before contracts really evolved into being these complicated documents. You know, back then it was a paragraph 5 of the base salary and maybe a minimal signing bonus or whatever, and that was pretty much it. You know, the funny thing is that the year before I got that pamphlet, I had somebody from the Players Association just read me the Cowboy salaries. And I was only in Dallas for about 2 months at that point. And at that period of time, the Dallas newspapers had always been more of an extension of the Cowboys organization than it was an independent operation. So I printed all the salaries. And it was, you know, bannered across the top page of the sports section of the Dallas Morning News. And I get two phone calls when they come out. One was from Drew Pearson, who wasn't mad about the salaries being put in the paper. He was mad because the number that I used for him was outdated by about 2 months. He had a new contract that pushed him past Butch Johnson, who was his backup. But in my list, what was given to me by the PA, Butch Johnson's contract was more than Drew, and Drew is the starter. So Drew is upset about that. The other phone call I got was from Doug Todd, who is, as you knew, knew him very well, John. You know, he's a PR director for the Cowboys. And he says, "You hurt my family." And I go, "Doug, what did I do? I'm sorry. What are you talking about?" He goes, "You printed the salaries in the newspaper." I said, "Well, but how did I hurt your family?" He goes, "The Cowboys are my family." And I said, "You better get used to me, because I approach things a little differently than the writers you were used to." And, you know, once Doug realized I was just doing my job and I tried to be fair and always honest, he started to appreciate me, but we got off to a pretty rough start.
I can imagine. I've been through that with the Steelers. But one thing that was great, of course, I mean, in HBO, get the New York Daily News columnist, one of the most recognized names in writing all through the country. But one of the great part is, you know, after moving to New York, you were able to get back to Dallas, at least in the sense that you wrote the book that's coming out now. How about them Cowboys, the Inside Huddle with Stars and Legends of America's Team? And the great part is, I mean, you were breaking all the stories in the Cowboys when you were there. You were able to break stories on the Cowboys when you were in New York. But talk a little bit about how about them Cowboys, because say what you want, America's Team is a fascinating team. I mean, you were at the forefront of covering them at interesting times. What did you get into in the book?
Well, you know, this is the fifth book that I've written, and I've always wanted to do a book just on the Cowboys. I did a kind of combination 49ers-Cowboys book a few years ago. I wrote about the catch, you know, Dwight Clark's catch, and how that was the beginning of the 49ers dynasty and the beginning of the end of the Landry era. But I really wanted in this book to just get into how, after more than 20 years of not being in the Super Bowl, this team is valued higher than any other sports franchise in the world, how it's still more popular than any franchise in the world, and what is it about their marketing and branding that has allowed them to do that. So that was my initial premise, and I was thinking I was going to try to carry that theme throughout the book. As it turned out, I did one chapter on that, and I call it Cowboys, Inc., which is really the business of the Cowboys. But the book is mainly just a behind-the-scenes kind of a pulling back the curtain on Jerry Jones and how the Cowboys operate. I got great access to Jerry and his, you know, three kids who – not kids, I mean, they're adults who help run the organization, about their interactions. I get into Jerry's relationship with Jimmy and with Parcells, and a chapter on Romo and Whitten. And so I really tried to pinpoint the things that I felt were most interesting. And because I always felt I had a good connection with readers, I felt using my judgment, what I felt was most interesting, that the readers would find that I picked the right stuff to write about. So I kind of spanned the three eras of the Cowboys, the Landry era, Jerry and Jimmy era, and the Jerry without Jimmy era. And I think it's really a fun read. It's very anecdotal, a lot of behind-the-scenes stories. And I really had a blast researching and writing it.
Yeah, I know. I had a blast being involved in the in the Hall of Fame contributor group, because I'm on the panel. And so, you know, it was always an interesting thing to see, is it going to be Jerry Jones or Pat Bowlen? And thank heavens that, you know, Pat now is nominated. He should be able to get in. But I remember the way the vote went, and, you know, what ended up happening was that, you know, Jerry was kind of the radical. He was the one who, you know, wanted to market things a different way. You know, back when the TV contract with Art Modell negotiated, there was going to be level. It was not going to really go up. He pushed to get it to go up, and it's been going up ever since. But talk about Jerry, the business person, and then we'll get into Jerry, the general manager. What is it about his business sense that's so good?
Well, I think he has great vision, and he's just a step ahead. And somebody like Wellington Mara was just so put off by Jerry early on. If you remember that 1995 Monday night season opener when Jerry walked across the field before kickoff at Giant Stadium with Phil Knight from Nike, just as they put out a press release about Jerry's side deal with Nike, which infuriated the NFL, and, and Wellington had a press conference the next day and said, you know, he actually felt sorry for Jerry because he didn't know what it meant to be a team player. By the time Wellington died in 2005, he really admired Jerry, and Jerry taught the Giants how to make money, like he taught every other owner in the league how to make money to really market their brand. And so many teams, especially the old-time franchises like the Giants, didn't do that. And so Jerry helped turn millionaires into billionaires, and he changed the way the NFL did business. Now all these teams have deals where they market their stadiums, and they have deals with companies that aren't necessarily the NFL sponsors, but are able to do it out on their own. And I mean, it's to the point where at Star, the Cowboys' new facility, that they have an unbelievable draft room, the war room. And I've been in it. There's 15 HD TVs and then a huge big screen TV, and they're able to run video of players side by side to compare them. Well, in order to help defray the cost of that room, Jerry cut a deal with one of the sponsors, and the sponsors hold a contest with their customers, and the winner gets to hold their fantasy football draft in the Cowboys war room. So the money that the Cowboys get from that over time will help defray all the money they put into putting that room together. And, you know, you say, oh, is that a big deal? Well, can you imagine Bill Belichick ever letting fans into his war room?
Never.
And Jerry just didn't think twice about it. Well, if we can make some money out of it, you know, let's do it. And I don't think it comes at the expense of winning, because he really does want to win. And he's so frustrated that they haven't been to the Super Bowl in such a long time. But there's nobody, and I put Robert Kraft number two on the list, but there's nobody that knows how to make money off of his team like Jerry Jones does.
But let's get into the football thing, because, of course, I mean, we were both at the owners' meeting when he was in the process of letting Jimmy Johnson go, and because I remember what bar were we in on that one? Because that's when he kind of hosted everybody, and then was kind of getting the idea. It's like, hey, what if I give this job to Barry Switzer and let Jimmy Johnson go? Who Jimmy Johnson, you know, was one of the great coaches. Eventually, we'll get him into the Hall of Fame because, I mean, he was so good, just both in personnel and with his imagination of, you know, getting that 4-3 defense on the field. Go back into that anecdote.
Well, it was the meeting in Orlando, and it was after they had won back-to-back Super Bowls. And Jimmy and Jerry got along much better when they were losing the first couple of years, because it bonded them. Everybody was taking shots at them, saying they were over their head. So they just kind of had each other to hold off the criticism. But once they started winning, and a lot of the credit was going to Jimmy because of the Herschel Walker trade, Jerry, you know, there wasn't enough credit to go around, and they started really having a contentious relationship. So you fast forward to winning back-to-back Super Bowls in 92 and 93, and they get to the league meetings, and, you know, Jimmy contends he was going to leave anyhow. But I don't necessarily believe that, only because it was already late March, and I think if he was going to leave, he would have done it already. So they have a party on that Monday night. I don't know if it was at a Disney property or one of those things, and there's a bunch of current and former Cowboys employees sitting around, including some people that Jerry had fired. And Jerry walks over the table and holds up a glass and says, hey, let's drink to the Cowboys. And he got a cold shoulder reception, including from Jimmy. And that just, Jerry was humiliated. So they get back to the hotel bar at the Hyatt. And I remember I was sitting there with Ed Werder and Rick Goslin and a couple other people. I can't remember if you were there at that.
No, I was there. I actually left after a while because I wanted to go to bed.
Well, here's the thing, is that I called Jerry over, hey, why don't you come sit down with us and have a beer? And he goes, I'll be back in a little while. And it was only like 1 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, those are early days at the league meetings where you have to be up by 8 or 8:30. So I didn't want to sit there all night waiting to see if he would come back. So I think like 1:30, quarter to two, I left. I went to sleep. And then I find out in the morning, you know, he comes back, and at that point, just Werder and Goose were there, and he starts talking about, you know, there's 500 coaches who can win the Super Bowl, and he starts really ripping Jimmy, which I think had a lot to do with what happened when he tried to propose that toast earlier in the evening. So, of course, I'm kicking myself that I didn't stick around. Maybe he would have only said it to the Dallas Morning News. You know, at that point, I was working in New York, so I don't know. But I would have at least liked to have been there to find out if he would have said that in front of me. But they did find out. There might not have been 500 coaches who can win with that team, but there was at least one other, because 2 years later, Barry Switzer won a Super Bowl, which My theory is if Barry Switzer won the Super Bowl with that talent, there probably were 499 other coaches that could have done it, because if Barry can do it, just about anybody could have done it.
Yeah, but of course, after that, things started falling apart because it didn't have the personnel vision of Jimmy Johnson.
Sure.
Let's go into the current Cowboy team, because and obviously the history that all through the Cowboys with How About Them Cowboys is going to be there. But I just find it amazing. Here, he gets a good quarterback in Dak Prescott. He gets a great running back in Ezekiel Elliott. And yet he pares down all the salaries with the exception of DeMarcus Lawrence to a point where he didn't take advantage and is not taking advantage of the low salary that Prescott's making. And you know he's going to pay him over $30 a year or whatever, big money. And so they're letting this window go because they're not getting enough talent. They're too young on defense, and there's not enough at the wide receiver position. What's going on with the current Cowboys?
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm not sure I agree with Dak getting that big second contract. I think that's to be determined whether he is going to be able to earn that. And this is a really big season for them. I mean, they're 2-2 after four games. He's got to prove that he needs to be paid in an elite category. You know, I think their defense is fine. I think it's going to be okay. You're right. You know, Lawrence is the one that's getting the big money, and probably Sean Lee, but they don't have the big money guys on defense anymore, but they got a lot of good young players. The problem, like you said, John, is on offense. I don't know what he was thinking going into the season after Jason Witten retired during the draft, and the Cowboys were given a heads up, you know, prior to the draft that was probably going to happen, and then letting Dez go, which I thought was the right thing because there was no separation anymore with the defensive backs. He dropped a lot of passes, was a distraction on the sidelines. I thought that was okay, but you have to – I mean, why didn't they take Calvin Ridley? And I know that's easy to say after Ridley has exploded the last 2 weeks, but it's not like this guy came out of nowhere. Everybody knew he was going to be a really good player, and the Cowboys passed on him, and Ridley went 8 spots later to the Falcons. I mean, just in terms of need, that would have seemed to be the logical choice. And then they didn't bring in any accomplished wide receivers. I mean, Allen Hurns, who had some good years in Jacksonville, but you wouldn't call him an elite receiver. They just left Prescott, you know, basically naked there, not having any weapons except for Zeke Elliott. And I don't get it. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me that you can go into a season, you know, with a quarterback going into his third year who you think is the long-term answer, with Elliott being able to play a whole season, and really just base their entire season on the offensive line being dominant. And you see what happened, you know, Frederick out with that illness, and the other guys aren't playing as well. That the whole thing is, you know, they're just having trouble moving the ball. And I think this, it doesn't look like this, you never know what's going to happen, but it doesn't appear that this is going to be a Super Bowl year for the Cowboys. And you're right, they're not taking advantage of the fact that they should have tons of extra cap space because of what they're paying the quarterback fourth round money.
Exactly. So now, as you go through inside, How About Them Cowboys? Basically, it's about, what, 4 to 5 decades of history plus the development, the changeover from Landry to Jerry Jones and all that
right.
stuff. What's one of the favorite things that you like in this book?
Well, it's actually a really personal story that I write about in the introduction. On the morning after Tom Landry got fired, and I really take the readers on the journey on the race to be the first to find Landry. If you remember, they had that Saturday night massacre, February 25th, 1989. Schramm and Jerry Jones had flown in Jones's private plane for Jones to give the word to Landry in person that he was firing him. And they come back to Dallas and have the press conference. And Tom's in Austin because he was down there playing golf. And I just figured that he'd definitely be coming back the next morning. So I drove to an airport in North Dallas that I knew Tom flew in and out of because it wasn't far from his house. And I sat there for about an hour and a half. And I didn't know what plane was his or anything like that, but I figured if I was there when he flew in, that I would definitely see him. And after about an hour and a half, I gave up and I drove to his house. And about a half hour after I get to his house, David Moore, who's now with the Morning News, but then was working for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, he drove up as I'm kind of sitting on the hood of my car waiting to see if Landry's around. There was no sign of anybody at the house. And David, so we do the stakeout together. And you know me, John, I'm as competitive as you are.
Yeah.
I was not happy that David was there. But at least it wasn't the Dallas Times-Herald. It was the paper in Fort Worth.
Right, right, right.
So we sat there for a while and then went got something to eat for lunch. And then we said, I wonder if there's any chance he went out to Valley Ranch, which was the Cowboys facility at the time. So we both drove out there. We saw Landry's car in his parking spot. In those days, we had key codes that allowed us in the building, and we had total access to the building. It was amazing in those days. You were able to walk around wherever you wanted. Now it's a star, the Cowboys' new facility. Johnny, there are security guards like every 40 feet. It's amazing. You'd think it was the Pentagon, the way that Jerry's got that thing protected. But back in 1989, we had free reign, and we walk over to Landry's office, and his longtime secretary is sitting out there, and she always called him Mr. Landry and said, you know, Mr. Landry's not available. And we can see Tom sitting in the office because the door was cracked open a little bit. And he goes, oh, that's all right. Let them in. So we sat there interviewing him for a little while, turning off the tape recorders, and then just talking to him as he was packing up his boxes. And looking back on it, and there were some of these thoughts going through my mind at the time, but not as vividly as now, I was thinking, I sat in on history. I watched Tom Landry pack up 29 years of memories into boxes like anybody else would have who loses their job. And his car's out in front, he had some of the equipment people help him carry boxes out to his car. And it was literally sitting in on NFL history. And although you wanted to feel bad for the man, he was so matter-of-fact about it that, hey, the guy bought the team. This is what happens when there's a turnover. I've been here for 29 years. I would have liked to have had a chance to turn the team, to turn this thing around by myself. But, you know, you can't always get what you want, and life goes on. And it was really like an amazing – that was an amazing morning that was one of the most memorable that I've had, you know, in my career, and certainly in my career covering the Cowboys.
Well, of course, that's the great part. I mean, you can get the whole history of the Cowboys and so much more. But again, the great part is great anecdotes and great stories called How About Them Cowboys Inside the Huddle with the Stars and Legends of America's Team. I can imagine bookstores and everywhere. Any other place to be able to get this?
Yeah, it goes on sale next Tuesday, October the 9th. And anybody who wants to pre-order it can do so on Amazon or any of those are online outlets.
Gary Myers, thanks for joining us. It's been great to talk to you on Schooled with the Professor.
John, thanks so much for having me on.
And that does it for this week's podcast. In between episodes, you can follow me on Twitter at ClaytonESPN. If you enjoy these weekly one-on-one conversations, consider leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening to the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Schooled with the Professor.